So last week we looked at two basic orientations around meditation practice, the technical practice that we would do with our attention when we're sitting, and talked about these are sort of like two general forms of instructions that you'll get. One is variations of instructions towards single-pointed focus or concentration practice. And the heart of that cultivation in most of the forms is to choose a single object to pay attention to, usually a sensory object, which could be bodily or mental, but like the breath or the body, specific parts of the body. It could be a mental image. It can be, in some traditions, like a verbal steady image, like a mantra. Whatever it is, it could be sounds passing, but it's the continuous sense of sound. Whatever it is, it's a continuity in the object field. And you stay with that, and the discipline is to engage with it, deepen into it, and not get distracted from it, to pull the mind back when it wanders, to put up a gentle boundary to other concerns while you're with it, and to let being with that one anchor bring the mind into steadiness. That practice requires being active. I'm steering my attention, I'm cultivating certain qualities, I'm bringing up qualities like calm or joy or investigation, mindfulness. And I'm actively trying to decrease qualities like the hindrances of restlessness, dullness, grasping, aversion, doubt, fear, confusion. And because I'm, in a sense, having to corral my attention into this steady thing, it takes some doing at first. As that practice develops, it gets very stable and less effortful. And the path toward deepening it is the path of decreasing effort. So the more you can relax, the more you can do less, but keep it steady, the deeper it goes. And at a certain point, the doing it part clicks off, and it has a very strong momentum unto itself. And when concentration gets established, it's very easy to continue it. But there's a big hill to get over before you get onto that nice, longer downhill. So that's style number one, concentration style, single-pointedness style. Style number two that that is really represented in traditions like Zen or Zazen, which means just sitting, and it's represented by the objectless meditations in Tibetan traditions like the practices described as Dzogchen or Mahamudra, and used very often also in the Advaita world. Is a practice that we could call open awareness, where I don't try to stick my attention to one thing, but it's like I rest with my attention available for any sensory stimulus, but still not distracted. So there's not a specific thing I'm holding on to. Anything can come and go, sights and smells, sounds, smells, tastes, sensations, thoughts, images, feelings. And there's a steadiness of gaze rather than a steadiness of object. Rather than trying to corral my mind to focus only on one thing, I let everything happen, but the corralling is actually to not hook onto any of it. And so you can think of it as not just a stabilizing of the object, but in a way a stabilizing of the subject. The witness is stable. So from my perch over here, the whole show plays out, but I don't let myself reach out toward any of it, or I try not to. And in that system, distraction is not so much distraction, because I'm not trying to prevent anything from arising. The hindrance or the interruption to that practice is simply losing touch with that witness or that stable subject base. One of the challenges between those two forms is that, especially in some traditions, the open awareness form has come with some particular ideologies, like the fact that, like the doctrine from Mahayana Buddhism that, and really expressed in the tantric forms, that everything is already perfect just as it is. That cultivation would be just to engage with objects more. And that in a sense, the witness or awareness itself is already perfect, already whole, never was stained or broken to begin with. Therefore, in a sense, you can go immediately to full non-doing, not trying to manipulate your experience. If anger arises, anger is what's arising. There's nothing that needs to be done particularly about it. And you can think of these two as kind of poles on a spectrum, right? A kind of doing pole and a non-doing pole, or an active and a passive pole. And within any given practice, you know, the amount of, the kind of effort I'm applying moment to moment or sitting to sitting or phase of my life to phase of my life changes, right? And sometimes it's possible. So mostly I think of the open practices being harder. There's less to hold on to. And so then when I want to do that kind of open practice, what I want, and this is built into the training forms that use that, like Zen monastic training or Dzogchen and Mahamudra, which are not beginner's practices. They come at the end of a very long, very formalized training sequence. So it's a little bit like when my energy is strong, when I have some concentration and ease and really a strong foundation of being able to rest and well-being in the mind, then it's like, yeah, I could let go of clinging onto any one meditation object and rest in openness. For me, the main thing that I need to do that is energy. If my energy is a little dull or wavery or scattered, I can't do it, right? I can't maintain the easy stability. I get swept away. When I have a little more clarity of energy, I can do it. I don't need to cling to the breath or a particular thing. I can just rest. And the resting actually deepens as rest. The mind is quietish. But it doesn't have to be completely quiet. It can rest in openness. So there's these two ways of entering in, and they're emphasized by different aspects of different traditions. Both of them, however, have, they seem to invite a similar kind of sequence of states as we sit. And I want to talk tonight a little just about a sitting period and what happens in it, and particularly about what this thing distraction is. What is it? What is a distraction? One of my deepest and most long-term teachers, Eugene Cash, who did come from the Zen tradition, or he didn't come from the Zen tradition, but he was inspired by it, clearly. And he came from some other traditions as well. But he had a bit of a non-dual or kind of Zen trickster feeling to him. And so he would start a Dharma talk by saying, you know, tonight I want to talk about the hindrances. But before we can talk about the hindrances, we have to understand that there's no such thing as a hindrance. Only then can we talk about hindrances. This is like that saying about gardening, that the only difference between, you know, a garden plant and a weed is that you prefer one over the other. And so the only difference between the meditation object and the distraction is that you prefer one over the other. And of course, the reason why some distractions come over and over is that you actually prefer them to the meditation object. The great distractions, the lust object, the object of greed, the thing I'm most afraid of, those things that come back again and again, prefer, in this case, it's not volitional. You're not meaning to prefer them. It's not like I'm trying to sit here and think about, like, you know, repetitive porn scenarios or, you know, killing somebody or destroying the government again and again and again. I don't mean to. But that's where the psyche sometimes goes. We were talking about long retreat, and I was like, oh, how repetitive the days are. Some days it's like, I've been here for a month and a half, my mind is pretty quiet, and then suddenly I'm just thinking about the Lord of the Rings again. You know? How many times do I have to think about it? Because there's something that draws the energy of the attention there. There's momentum in the psyche. So you sit down to meditate, you assemble your posture, you kind of, there's this first kind of landing in. And I feel like it happens on kind of body, heart, mind level. So the body kind of finds itself, you adjust a little bit, and you're settling toward a stillness or an approximate stillness that's as comfortable as you can. So you find basically the first sort of settled plateau in the body. Likewise, in the emotions, you're swirling in whatever it is, and you start to just settle and calm, and the intention that we're sitting arises. Like, oh, now this is that meditation period thing. And something in you shifts into your familiarity with that. What happens when you take this posture and this inner stillness, even the intention for stillness? And you might become aware of your mood a little bit. But often it either swirls a little bit less, or you see how it's swirling. And in both cases, there's an orientation, a getting grounded, getting caught up with myself. And the mind, particularly in the first moments of sitting, very often, for almost anybody, the first moments of sitting have some quiet to them. You sit down, you assemble yourself, you look at the breath, and boom, the mind just clears out for a second. And maybe it really is like for a second, you know. And then it's like the momentum is so strong, I'm just back into doing my list. I'm like, oh yeah, I'm sitting. But very often there's, again, a first little plateau. Oh, it's quiet. And then that thing happens that we call distraction, where suddenly I notice that I'm thinking about something, or I'm sort of churning some feeling through and processing something in some way, or the body's fidgety or dull or something. So like I hit that plateau in body, feeling, and mind. Everything settles for a moment, and in a sense, in that moment of everything having settled, I'm in the stream of what I'm intending to do. I've assembled my energies, and now I'm here doing this. I connect with the breath, body calms. There's a moment of just like, just that. And then for whatever reason, and the reason is momentum, which means karma, something pings the mind. And it can be anything, of course, right? And it can be and mostly we don't even notice what it is. I hear a squeak, and my mind thinks of something, and then it thinks of something else. And five thoughts down the line, I'm thinking about, you know, how I have to stop at the store and get some cream on the way home. How did it get there? Right. What we can notice then is that sensory information, and in the Buddhist system, sensory includes the mind, so thoughts are sensory information. A memory is something that is sensed. And you could think of it as like sensory information is anything that witness can notice. Anything that can arise in consciousness is a piece of information. And it doesn't take a physical trigger to make a thought happen, right? Or the physical trigger can be so micro that you don't even notice it. I hit that first plateau, mind is quiet, presence is assembling, and then the force of thought returns, and I launch into something. And the classic meditation instruction, the classic kind of modernist meditation instruction for that moment is that the beginning of the mind getting distracted, launching off, mostly we don't see it until you get a little more concentration going. When you get kind of concentrated, you get really quiet, mind gets really still. What it felt to me was, and I hear a lot of folks describe this, so there may be some familiarity, with this sensation of mind is pretty quiet. And it's almost like there's a little bloop of energy and it hasn't even formed into a thought yet. But it's kind of just like a little... And what it feels like to me, I say it's down here somewhere because I feel sometimes kind of pulled. But it's almost like... It's almost like my sense of... I'm a magnet. And my sense of presence happens when I'm not being pulled in any direction. Or I've magnetized myself to the thing, the breath, whatever. And then what'll happen is another magnet will pass by. And there's a little like pull of energy. Sometimes it doesn't pass by very close, and I have some concentration, and I don't just immediately abandon the thing I'm stuck to, the steel of the breath, and just like bloop, onto this other thing. But I can feel a little pull, a little tug on my mind. And if mindfulness is bright and there's enough energy, I can feel that tug, notice it immediately, and be like, nope. I don't need to do that right now. I can stay. But when there's not energy and strong mindfulness, which is the case in a lot for a lot of us, for most of our daily sittings, it actually happens quicker than I can notice. Mindfulness is slow. Energy is dulled. And so I don't actually feel the pull. All I notice is that I've switched and I've magnetized to the other thing. And now I'm thinking about Lord of the Rings or Cream or squeaky mice in the walls or whatever's happening. So mostly we don't notice the pull and the switching of attention. What has happened is attention has just switched objects. It switches to that object, and in a little while or a longer while, but at some point, mindfulness reemerges. And essentially, the practice of strengthening mindfulness is to make it automatically reemerge quicker. Right? So, like, think about it this way. If you don't notice the switch of attention from one object to another, then you're not going to notice that you're with it for a while. And at some point, you do notice what happened there. Right? It can't be volitional. It's not that you're choosing to notice it and then like, oh, now I'll be mindful of this thought. As soon as that has happened, you've already noticed it. As soon as you can say, this thought, you've noticed it. So mindfulness is a non-volitional quality. You train in it. We do things that strengthen it. But when the mind is distracted or it's on the non-chosen or non-intended object, it is chosen in a certain way, subtly. Who's choosing? But it is, in a way, chosen. That was a deep teaching on anatta. You got it. The non-intended object. But it appears at some point, and the stronger mindfulness is, the quicker it appears. Some implications of this. First of all, for that duration where you've lost the intentional object and you've turned to the non-intentional object for a period of time, the amount of time that passes between when you forget and you remember again, and remember that the word mindfulness is a translation of the word for memory, sati, or smriti, it just means remember. So the moment between forgetting and remembering, you are offline. And what that means in a way is that it's not your fault. It's not your fault how long you're asleep. You can't do anything about it other than, once you get back, continue to cultivate the conditions for it to be shorter the next time. But there's no way that you can volitionally shorten that once it's happening. So, no blame, right? As soon as you, and this is embedded in the instructions, you say, when you notice yourself thinking, don't get all judgmental, just come back. Don't worry about it. And that's the cycle, then, is you land at whatever plateau or depth of stability, steadiness, calm, energy, ease, presence you can. You sustain that as long as you can with the energy that you have, the ease, the all the qualities. It slips, you don't notice for a while, you do notice, and as soon as you notice, you just begin again, essentially. The instruction often has a directional metaphor to it. You got lost and you come back. And it feels like that. Sometimes I play with not going going with the directional or the spatialness of the metaphor and actually feel like, no, actually the sensory object of the breath and the sensory object of the thought are actually both right here. And actually they're both in the body. There's no thought outside of the body. And so, in a way, all that happened is my attention flipped from one embodied experience to another. And the only problem with that is that I am trying to cultivate the one and diminish the other. And the reason for that is that not because thinking is bad in any way, or even that the mind shifting to another thing, there's anything wrong with that. It's so natural. It's that because I think of the same forces in our animal beings that make us pay more attention to the negative than the positive, the part of us that is on the lookout for danger or threat. This is animal biology from being a prey animal. Threat or negativity is more compelling than ease and positivity. Because if the tiger is salivating and looking in your direction, it's more important to notice that than to notice how lovely the bluebells are, even though the bluebells are very lovely. Right? So we are built to have what the psychologists call negativity bias. In the organic intelligence world, we call it the red habit. I turn toward the negative or the discomfort or the painful habitually because my system thinks I'm being threatened. Something hurts a little bit, it might be a threat, I can't take my eyes off of it. Unfortunately, and this is the basis of trauma, most of those threats are not real threats. The vast majority of them are not real threats. I'm not in danger from a hip ache or the fact that I owe somebody, some edits on a paper. I'm really not. Really, really, I'm not. You're not. And so then I have to somehow deal with this habit of looking for the negative. What the distractions are is not, they're not random, like, oh, I thought about this thing for a while and then I came back. If the breath is a fairly, like, ethically neutral for most people object, it doesn't have a lot of necessarily kind of emotional charge itself. And if it does for you, it's not a good meditation object. If you've been asthmatic, or you were caught in a fire, or you suffocated, or you had a drowning experience, or something, where the breath is a charged emotional experience, don't make it your meditation object. Process it in some way. Do it in therapy. Do it in a form where you're really trying to work through those emotions. But the meditation object, if it's going to get you to that kind of stability, has to be something that has itself a kind of calm and stability. So the meditation object is neutral. The thoughts aren't. And the thoughts are almost always colored by, in a certain way, I would say always, because they're... So distractions are always colored by one of these hindrances. So these two hindrances around the energy spectrum, too high or too low, restlessness, dullness. Then there's two hindrances that are the classic kind of volitional hindrances of grasping and pushing away. Or their emotional or emotional energetic components of lust and hatred. Really wanting something, really hating it. And so these two spectra, the tradition, I think, wisely recognizes these are charged, forceful qualities connected with some object, some sensory object, a thought, a feeling, an image, whatever, that pull us away from deepening in stability and ease and stillness. Right? If there's too much energy in the body, it's hard to get still. If there's not enough, it's hard to get still. If I'm connecting really with the energy of wanting something, it's hard to get still. If I'm really connected with the energy of not wanting something, it's hard to get still. And this is why distractions themselves can be either pleasant or unpleasant, and it doesn't matter. They're still distractions. And in a way, the pleasant ones are harder to uproot. Because who wants to stop thinking about something that makes you so happy thinking about it? Especially even if the thing you're thinking about is actually quite wholesome. I'm thinking about how wonderful the Dharma is. I'm thinking about how wonderful my wife is, my child. I'm thinking about how much hope I have for the world. You know, some of which I do have, really. Those are beautiful thoughts. And they're worth having. But in the context of the particular garden bed that I'm working on, the calm, stability garden bed, they're a hindrance. All right, they're colored by some amount of energy's a little too high, it's a little restless, and a little bit of grasping. And sometimes when that's happening, I'll recognize that and I'll be like, oh, this is a hindrance to like concentration and stillness. But it's actually, they're actually beautiful qualities. I feel really loving or something. And I might just choose to go with that and be like, okay. And I switch to that. And what I'm doing is I'm switching meditation objects. And right from our whole conversation, we spent 2 months reading through the Metta Sutta, right? Essentially, what am I doing? I'm just turning into a Brahmavihara. I'm like, oh, now I switch to loving kindness practice, basically. So if the meditation object is wholesome, and it's like love or compassion or equanimity or joy, or generosity, gratitude, you might find it arising naturally, or you might choose to actually meditate on it, and that just becomes the stabilization object. So then you put that in the place of the breath and you restabilize on it. You could choose to do that. Or you can be like, no, I'm choosing the breath today. I love you all later. And you're like, I'm not going to enter the Brahmavihara right now. I'm going to stay in the continuity of breath practice. And that's just a choice you would make. So anything that's a distraction is not just a random thought or a sensory impulse, but it's connected to one of these core hindrances. The energy spectrum, the kind of volitional, emotional, volitional activity spectrum, grasping and aversion. And then the fifth, the terrible demon in the heart, the fifth hindrance is doubt. Doubt. Doubt is that force that comes along and says, you know, I can't do it, the system doesn't work, the teacher doesn't know what they're talking about, we're all going to hell, it's not going to work, it's not going to work, it's not going to work, in whatever way. And doubt is the most insidious, it's sneaky, it's terrible, it kills meditators. In the early texts, doubt is the only one of the hindrances that's personified as a demon with a voice that comes to practitioners, including the Buddha, including after he's enlightened, and annoys them. Comes in and says, oh, blessed one, feeling a little tired, are we? Where's all that enlightened energy? You know, like, and so this being is named Mara. And he or she is a mythically an analog or related, a descendant of the god of death, Yama. They have parallels in their myths. So doubt and death are not all that separate. And again, it's a hindrance because it's not chosen. In a different moment in your practice, you might be like, it is time to assess my practice with cold, clear, you know, critical eyes and be like, this is not working, right? That's not doubt. It might be the same thought process, but when it's chosen, it becomes your focus. It becomes essentially the meditative object or the inquiry object. So, distraction is always colored by energy. It's never just thought. There's always a charge. And that charge is going to be, you can map that charge onto the set of the hindrances. Then what do you do? You sense it, oh, I'm distracted. And you could just come back, especially if the energy is very, very thin or light, like it's just a little blip of a thought, don't worry about it, right? It's just a tiny little burp of energy, and you just resettle very easily. But for the great distractions, the ones that come again and again or that pull you away for a long time, rather than just being like, ah, again, and come back, you can say, oh, this, what is this? And there's it's really just kind of layers, and we can use the sort of not really three separate things, but three separate things breakdown of body, heart, mind to look at this. Body, heart, mind. So like, the direction doesn't matter actually, right? But this is what we do. So very often you discern the distraction first as thought. So there's a story, there's a narrative or a visual image. You identify that. The second layer down, and you can, and if again, if there's not that much below it, if there's not that much strong of an energy, you just could be like, yep, and come back. But for the deep ones, there's going to be more. And the next layer down, you could call the heart layer or the emotional or feeling layer. So you're going to get that that story or image is connected to a feeling. There's an emotional impulse there. And the emotional forces then you can map onto the hindrances. There's a wanting force, there's a fearing or disliking force, there's a kind of frazzled force and a dulled force. And within those, there's, you know, it breaks out. So, you know, in the pleasant charge column, there's, you know, good things that I want and bad things that I want. Stimulation, love, partnership, connection, peace. Things that I might grasp onto. But the energy behind it is the grasping energy. In the things I don't like column is stuff that I'm afraid of, stuff that I dislike, I'm judgmental of. Sometimes I myself am in that category. And so from the story or image, you can drop into the feeling level. And sometimes that's enough. You just feel it as like, oh yeah, I'm grasping a little, or I'm pushing away, and you feel it as a kind of force in your being. And you hang out with it for a moment and it settles. Mostly it settles when you come out of the narrative layer into the energetic layer. Because the energy can't really sustain without the narrative. Very often the narrative is the sensory stimulus for the emotion to be sustaining. In other words, I feel uncomfortable and here's why. If I stop telling myself the why, the feeling is actually going to fade because it's not reacting to anything. There's no evidence that there's a tiger here. And so it just subsides. But very often, here's what's happening. Ah! Here's what's happening. Ah! Oh my God, I'm freaking out. Ah! But here's what's happening. Ah! So every micro thought re-triggers the energetic response, the nervous system response. So come out of the narrative layer into the emotional layer and it will tend to disperse. The deepest layer of that, which is not separate from really the emotional layer, is the body layer. But we can say body is like, oh, it's not just sadness. There's a sort of heaviness in my bones that I can feel. Or it's not just wanting. It's like an urge through my belly that I can feel. And so the third of the layers to connect with, especially if something is really strong, is to really come into body sensation itself. And be like, oh, yeah, I'm just like with that thing. And again, if it's not too strong, if you can hang out with it, hang out with it. And you'll notice that sequence, drop the narrative, come through the feeling or emotional tone and really into the body, is also the pathway that leads you back to the present moment as both embodied presence and your meditative object, which is going to be a present moment object, like the breath or the body. So it's a pathway back, and it's a pathway to process whatever is sticking you in that distraction. This is a version of the coming back. It's not taught as often. Very often the instruction is just notice and come back. And I offer it this way because I just know so many folks who struggled with concentration for 20 years. myself included. And so many of those years, I can't tell you how many sittings I sat through that where I was mostly distracted. 5 minutes of presence in an hour-long sitting. Because the only instruction I was ever given was to kind of just, in a rote sort of way, just come back. But it didn't do anything to process feeling. And so that my mind would just go to the same places over and over and over again. I remember noticing that I had meticulously designed in my mind houses that I wanted to live in over and over and over for about 5 or 6 years in my practice. In profound detail, I had done pristine Japanese carpentry. I had done every detail of straw bale building. I had gone through several designs of the whole thing. And finally it settled. I basically found that I was resting back on the same design again and again. I found my perfect design. But actually what I noticed in the end was like, oh my God, I've been thinking about houses for years and years. What is really going on? Like, what do I have to know about this? I got frustrated and I was like, oh man. I just crave a home base. Like, I just feel uprooted. And when I finally got there, it was like, okay, it took me 6 years to drop out of the narrative layer into the feeling layer. As soon as I did that, I figured it out. I was like, oh yeah, this is that feeling of just wanting a home. As soon as I felt that, I was like, yep, I want that. That distraction disappeared. I've never thought about it again in meditation. So then the encouragement here is that all distractions have an emotional quality and an energetic quality to them. And that dropping down into the energy, the feeling, and the body in it for the ones that have deep roots will reveal to us what they are and will help to dissolve them quicker over the life of our practice and will deepen in concentration. And I think this is the pathway towards samadhi. That's a training pathway toward deepening in samadhi. So, thoughts and reflections here.
So, I will say I'm going to sit and I'm going to have the object of my concentration be my breath, mm-hmm. and I will be there, mm-hmm. and then either, you know, construction will start outside or birds will sing outside, and I'm like, oh, not a distraction, I'll focus on the sound, mm-hmm. and I'll shift, and the object of my concentration will be the sound. Mm-hmm. And I'll do that, and then I'll do that, and then I'm like, oh, my friend Judith, who recently died, I'm thinking about Judith. Oh, the object of my concentration is metta on Judith. And partially that feels like I'm doing what you're suggesting, but partially that feels like kind of gaming the system. And I've been told, mm-hmm. if you're going to do metta. And uh-huh. if you then start to, you know, do sound, that is inappropriate or not best practice.
Uh-huh.
So that's my...
Yep. You're not gaming the system, but you're hovering between the two meditation forms a little bit. Mm. You're doing something that's like a more or less open awareness, where you have enough concentration to sustain on a given object for a little while, but not too long. And so then... essentially, you're allowing each distraction to become a new object of meditation for a little while. And so you're doing open awareness practice, basically. And the hybrid is that you're giving it some attention and volition to staying with each thing for a while. You might experiment with... So then, the thing that you're not developing is object continuity. Or the deep relaxation of full open awareness. You are developing some concentration, but not much. the thing you're developing that's not concentration is actually kind of like engagement, which is a different good quality. Like, you're learning how to dig into each thing and settle with it. And so that's almost like a, it's almost like an investigation quality of mindfulness. Especially if, as you hang out with each thing, you notice, for instance, its unsatisfactory nature or its selfless nature or its impermanence, you're kind of doing a sort of pure vipassana. But the thing you're not developing is continuity, which would mean you either stick with the one object and really try to, you know, notice the pull for sounds, but just process them enough to stay. Or you go full open awareness and you actually just rest and don't try to stay with anything. But when you notice the sounds, you're just like, and there's sounds. And there's Judith. May she be well. And there's the breath. And there's my butt. And there's the breath. And then you're really taking out the kind of trying to stay on anything piece. And then you can relax more into the open style. So you might experiment going one or two of the directions. Or really notice what quality you're building in what you're doing. And then ask if that's the quality you want. Yeah. Yeah. Very often a variation of this is given as a kind of insight-oriented practice with some concentration where you have an anchor like the breath, and then, you know, you let yourself really rest in and investigate something for a while and then come back to the breath, and it's like you're taking day trips from a camp. Mm-hmm. You know, I take a day trip to sound and I come back to the base camp of the breath. I take a day trip to Judith and I come back to the base camp of the breath. And then, yeah, you can let go of the base camp and just wander. And I think the heart of doing that is that you're working on insight. You're wanting to see things clearly. So then it's not a concentration practice per se. Yeah. Other thoughts?
I'm thinking about the difference between the narrative and the naming of the emotion. Mm-hmm. So the narrative in your house example is like the design and the connection and the attachment. But yeah, the narrative is also the home, the sense of home, the wanting of home.
Yeah, yeah. There's a big blurry line between thought and feeling,
yeah,
you know, and between feeling and body. In a way, you know, I use the word spectrum a lot. It's kind of how I organize qualities in my mind. Body, heart, mind sounds like three different things, but it's a version, what I call it in my formal work is the spectrum of materiality. That there's sensory material that is more rooted in bodily or physical sensations that are the kind of gross level physical sensations. And then there's a whole spectrum of increasing refinement containing lots of things to sensory material that is less connected to direct sensory present things, that like thought, you know.
So it has more of a charge to it, more of a energetic.
Right, like it's just a broad spectrum of things. So like the naming of an emotion is the little tiny narrative piece that helps me recognize what a feeling is. What is a feeling anyway, other than, you know, a way that we talk about a body and a story having a relationship? One of the interesting pieces in kind of emotion theory right now, between psychology and neuroscience, is that the things we call emotions might just be stories about our life that the mind came up with in order to explain an uncomfortable or a strong physical sensation. Mm. So the body is first. So like somebody says something to me and I get kind of hot and contracted. And And I don't like it, or I do like it, but either way, the mind doesn't know what to do with that because it's my state has shifted. And so it comes up with a like, oh, I'm so mad that you said that. But it's actually possible to let that just be the narrative and be like, oh, look, they said that, and then my body got so hot, you know, and that thing I call shame or anger or whatever arose. And what is the emotion but this kind of field of experience that has a strong bodily component and a strong narrative component, right? And they're both present, right? It's not mad. There's not a thing to get mad at. It's just heat. But the heat didn't arise independent of the narrative, so they're totally, you know, interwoven. And so then the labeling is like a tiny narrative blip that helps me name the thing, but it also helps me be with it more clearly. So I'm like, what is this strange feeling I'm feeling that's hard to concentrate on? But if I go, oh, this is shame, then I can be like, oh, that's what this is. It's hot, it's contracted, it's buzzy, it's chaos, it's I was going to say fearful, but then I was like, what does that mean? Oh, there's a kind of wanting to withdraw somehow. Like I can identify these qualities in it. And that's what I want to do if I want to process an emotion, is really be able to kind of be present with it, feel it, feel my way through it, know what's there. So yeah. So in a sense, body, heart, mind, like they're all just present all the time. You're not ever in just one. You know, there's always an energy with a thought. There's always a name for a bodily sensation.
When you speak about all these spectrums,
yeah.
I think that's a really great framework, and I actually recently touched into that with the dynamic of going away and coming back. Mm-hmm. Like actually there's a whole spectrum there that I've noticed, and I'm just curious, like do you have thoughts about that, like about, because there's like a, it's interesting to me that when we're in like a spacey state, which seems like a totally disconnected, I'm not even present kind of state, we can still have awareness.
Mm-hmm.
And so like that kind of dynamic kind of really makes me think that it's not as simple as like, oh, we're just away or back.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really not.
Can you speak a little bit about maybe that spectrum?
Sure. Yeah. I think actually that what we're describing when we say, you know, I got lost or I was away in a train of thought or something and then I came back, is actually that my attention just moved along the materiality spectrum from being engaged with physical reality to being engaged with mental or imaginal reality, and it did it in a non-volitional way. I didn't intend to start thinking about something that's not happening right now. But my attention was drawn along that spectrum in that way. And there is this sense, and I think this is a metaphor in some way, but I think it's a useful one, that when my attention is in contact with what we could call present moment sensory information, but I'll just say sensory information closer to the material side of the materiality spectrum, we call that being present.
Mm-hmm.
Why is it not present when I'm thinking?
Mm-hmm.
Of course I'm present. When else is anything going to happen? That's when thoughts happen, is right now. But what we can look at is switch it out of like, I was present, I was not present, to my attention was engaged with things that are material in the moment, or volitional, or my attention was engaged with the non-volitional and the non-material. So, oh, I was remembering yesterday. But if I consciously say, let me bring up that thing that happened yesterday and I consciously think about it, I feel like I'm being present, even though I'm shifting my attention to the imaginal. So presence and non-presence, I think, engages both the materiality spectrum, what I'm looking at, and the volitionality spectrum, how much I feel like I have agency or choice in relation to what I'm doing. And so non-presence, in a certain way, is always not chosen. if I choose to become non-present, what I'm doing actually is just pulling my attention away from a certain realm of sensory experience and doing something else. Like if I was like, oh, I don't want to be present for this circle, therefore I'm going to close my eyes and consciously like meditate or think about something else. I'm actually quite present. I'm not lost. I'm just choosing to do something else. So the thing we call, oh, I wasn't present, I think it has to have the qualities of non-volitionality embedded in it, and then it tends to be in the imaginal realm because sensations are always present. You know, if you can feel it, it's happening there. You know? In the same way, if you can notice the thought, you're present. So yeah, those are two of the spectrum that I think about for the kind of distraction process. Yeah.
I just had one more quick.
Yeah.
There is sometimes when I'm doing something like a body scan or something, and I'm going piece by piece through my body, like I'll still be able to have the sensations in my body, like my awareness on them, but then there's also thought. So it's like, it's true that there's like that non-volitional piece, but then there's still some connection to the sensations in the,
body. Yeah. The tradition that you've been practicing in and that I also practice in would say, look closer. And that what you'll find actually is that those two streams of things do seem to be happening at the same time. They both have momentum. But what's happening attentionally is that you're actually flickering back and forth between them quickly. You notice the thoughts, you notice the body part. And you can do that quite fast. You know, but this is core, especially to later early Buddhism in the Abhidhamma, that consciousness and perception can only consciousness can only perceive a single sensory phenomena at once. You can't actually perceive two things at a time. It doesn't work that way. And we could say the mind, the brain, is a parallel processor. It totally does on these other levels, but from an experiential perspective, with like, where is my attention, which is the thing I'm trying to develop when I'm learning to concentrate. As a practice, it seems to be true and useful that I can notice that my attention is only actually on one thing at a time. So some things, I know it's going on in the background, but there's either not much attention there. And when concentration gets strong, there's no attention there. So like you stop being able to hear sounds, you stop actually being able to receive sensory input. The mind, the thinking mind, stops entirely. Which doesn't mean that like cognitive activity has stopped, but it's fully disappeared from perception because you're so focused. So, cool. All right, that's good. So we'll continue this month looking at kind of technical details of meditation. It's fun to talk about in some detail with you. So, I'll be here through the month. Again, retreat in January. We'll have a sub in January. We might have a sub for the day after Christmas, which I think is a Tuesday, depending if the studio is even open that night. So look on my website or the Namaste website to see if the studio is open, somebody will be here. It might be me. If we're still in town, it might be somebody else if we're not. So.